So how do we explain the fact that the Biebel configuration are distributed according to the standard probability density over an ensemble? So that's the problem that I want to address. In fact, there is an easy answer to this question. You can simply assume that the Biebel are distributed according to the standard probability density for some initial time T0, and then automatically, if you have this property of quantum equilibrium at the initial time T0, it will be the case for any later time T, thanks to the fact that the de Broglie-Bohm theory is equivariant. But so this answer is a bit dissatisfying because you have to assume that the wave function plays two different roles. So the first role, that's kind of an ontic role, the wave function has to guide the particle. So that's a real field on configuration space that guides a particle. So that would be the ontic role. And on the other hand, it plays kind of an epistemic role. It says something about the rho equal to psi square, about how the particle should be distributed according to, about how the particle should be distributed according for the initial time T0. So it's a bit dissatisfying. So another answer has been proposed by these authors, so Dürr, Goldstein, and Zhangyi. And what they say is that most Biebel configuration at the level of the universe would lead to quantum equilibrium at the level of the subsystem, where most is understood with respect to the psi square measure, where psi square now would be the wave function of the universe. But I'll explain a bit more this reply. And the second answer. Well, not the second, but in fact it was proposed before, but another type of answer is to say that you don't have to assume that particle positions are distributed according to the standard probability density. You can start from an ensemble in which the particles are not distributed according to a standard probability density, and if you let this system evolve, then it would relax to quantum equilibrium. But on a coarse grain level, and also for wave functions which are not trivial. And the good thing about this reply by Valentini is that it also leads to new physics. Because if you assume that the universe was initially in a state of quantum non-equilibrium, or a better way to put it, if you assume that the universe in the beginning was atypical, then there is the possibility there would still be a very special particles still in quantum non-equilibrium today. And these are the relic non-equilibrium particles. And if you find these, you could use them to lead to experiment that would lead to deviations from standard quantum mechanics. And finally, I will say a bit more about two recent work about relaxation to quantum equilibrium. So the first one, that's with Warstreuf. And so if you remember from the first lecture, so I said that it's possible to construct infinitely many theories like the de Broglie-Bohm theory in which particles have positions and are guided by wave function. And all these theories, they would simply differ by how the wave function guides the particle. And if you consider quantum equilibrium distribution, they all lead to the same prediction. But now if you consider quantum non-equilibrium distribution, they lead to different predictions. And so we have studied the process of relaxation to quantum equilibrium in this alternative de Broglie-Bohm type theories. And the most recent work, it's in collaboration with Warstreuf again and with Anthony Valentini, and it's about the study of relaxation to quantum equilibrium in Bohm's dynamics, where Bohm's dynamics is understood as the theory in which the acceleration of the particle is given by minus the gradient of the sum of the classical and quantum potential. Whereas, by contrast, the Broglie's dynamics, that's the theory in which the velocity of the particle is given by the gradient of the phase of the wave function divided by the mass. And so, in principle, Bohm's dynamics allow for a much larger class of non-equilibrium distribution, But also, it's easy to find counterexample to the claim that all non-equilibrium distribution would relax to quantum equilibrium. And that's what I'll say. That's what I will explain in the end. So, I'll first consider the first answer proposed by Dürr, Goldstein, and Zanghi. So they consider a Bohmian universe. So you have a big wave function, psi u t xu, where xu would denote all the position of all the particles in your universe. And so their claim is that for most choices of initial Biebel configuration, you would have that quantum equilibrium holds at the level of the subsystem inside of your universe. But now I have to explain two things. So how is the subsystem defined in the Breuil-Bohm theory, and what do they mean by most configuration of your Biebel configuration for the universe? So here is our subsystem defined in the De Broglie-Bohm theory. So you look at your Biebel configuration space, and you make a splitting between particles, position of the particles that belong to your system, and position of the particles that belong to your environment. And the splitting, it can be made very easily. For instance, you could consider like a region in R3, and you say that all the particles that are inside of that region, they belong to the system, and all the particles that are outside of the region, they belong to the environment. But now, in the De Broglie-Bohm theory, so your complete description of your universe is not only given by the wave function, but also by the actual position of the particles that belong to the system, and the position of the particles that belong to the environment. And in order to define the wave function for your subsystem, so they start with this wave function, and they simply replace this object here by the actual position of the particles that belong to the environment. So in the end, you have an object, a wave function that only depends on the position of the particles that belong to the system. And now I will explain why this is a meaningful definition. And they call this the conditional wave function for the system. And in order to see that it's a meaningful definition, we can go back to a situation in which we do a measurement. So if you remember, in a measurement-like situation, the total wave function will end up at the end of your measurement procedure, the total wave function will end up in a superposition of different branches. And all these branches, they correspond to different macroscopic states for your apparatus. And so here, what I denote by this blue dot, that's simply the support of the branches. And so they have disjoint support, simply because they correspond to pointer states which are different. And now if you look in the Breuil-Bohm theory, there is an actual Biebel configuration. So you have position for the particles that belong to the system, and you have positions for the particles that belong to the apparatus. And this Biebel configuration will select one of these branches. And that's when you say that you have a definite outcome for your measurement. And now if you look at the guidance equation for the position of the particle that belong to the system. So it happens that if you substitute in the expression, if you substitute the position of the apparatus, you will simply, you do easy algebraic manipulation, and you will find out that the velocity of the particles that belong to the system is given by this expression, where phi k would be the wave function of your system that corresponds to this result of the measurement that I call k simply. But here the important thing to notice is that there is no dependence on the wave function of the apparatus, and there is no dependence on the position of the particles that belong to the apparatus. And that's exactly what you would have obtained if you would have used the previous, that's exactly this conditional wave function. And if you have, if you say in the standard interpretation, when I do this measurement, what's the wave function for my system in the end? You would simply say phi k after the measurement has been performed, and that's exactly what's happening in the de Broglie-Bohm theory. So it matches what you would expect. And now, even if you have in your universe, even if you have different subsystems that have interacted with environment, if this system have interacted with environment in procedures which are identical to measurement-like situation, you can simply disregard the environment and consider a wave function for your universe, which is simply a product of identical wave function psi. And here I'm simply forgetting all the rest of the universe. So I'm considering a situation in which the universe contains n identical copies. They can be in different places of the universe, for instance. But each of them is described by the same wave function psi. And now I have to say something about the second part. So I have defined the subsystem, and I have to say what do they mean by most initial configuration of the universe. So here is the wave function for our non-relativistic universe, and we simply pick one configuration, xu. So that would be a point in configuration space of dimension R3n. And so this point specifies all the particles, the position of the particles that belong to the different system. And now, once you have picked out this point, you can define an empirical distribution. So you look at, for each interval x plus dx, you simply count the number of positions that belongs to this interval, and you build some kind of histogram. And if you pick out the position configuration for your universe uniformly, so here is what you would typically observe. You would observe some uniform density. But now, so the previous author, Bill Goldstein and Zhang-Yi, they argue that you should not attribute the same weight to all the configuration of the universe, but that that these configurations should be attributed a weight psi u x u squared. So if you pick out a configuration where psi squared is big, so its weight would be bigger. And then they show that if you do this, and if you build this empirical distribution, typically you would observe a psi squared distribution. But now, for some people, the argument seems a bit circular, because you want to explain why you observe psi squared at the level of the subsystem, but then you pick out the universal configuration according to psi squared. So it seems like, well, you are putting in the beginning what you want to obtain in the end. And so they have to argue why psi squared is a good measure to count the universal configuration. Why not using the Lebesgue measure that would give this result? And then the authors argue that psi squared, that's the good measure because that's an equivariant measure. And it has this property of stationarity. So once you are in a distribution rho equals psi squared, it will remain rho equals psi squared for any data time. So that's why they argue that it's a good measure. And then some people said, well, we don't know whether psi squared is the only equivariant measure. And then there was a result recently by Goldstein and Struve in which they showed that psi squared is indeed the only, well, under reasonable assumption that psi squared is the only equivariant measure. Whether you like this argument or not, you are still left with the possibility that after all your universe might be atypical. For instance, at the level of classical statistical mechanics, if our universe that we see around us would be typical, well, the density would be kind of uniform, and of course that's not the case. But now, if you consider this hypothesis that the universe might be atypical, that would mean that quantum equilibrium doesn't hold at the level of the subsystem. And if it doesn't hold at the level of the subsystem, you have to explain why today we don't see any quantum non-equilibrium. And there you have to invoke Valentini's conjecture, that if you start from ensembles in which the particles are not distributed according to psi squared, they would simply relax to quantum equilibrium. And so that's the claim that I will analyze now. But before going into the details, so I will give a simple example of what it means for a system to be in non-equilibrium, and see if you do an experiment with a non-equilibrium distribution, what it will look like. So here is a typical example. You have an ensemble, and you have, so the blue curve, that's psi squared. And now let's assume that each time you make a position measurement, you see that the particle belongs to the right-hand side of the packet. So you see the right position is always on the right hand side. So that would be, and if this is the case for all the elements of the ensemble, this would be a non-equilibrium distribution, because the density, the distribution of right particle position is different from psi squared. And now if you would use this non-equilibrium distribution, and if you would do, let's say, a double-slit experiment, that's the kind of pattern that you could observe. So if you do the double-slit experiment, well, the wave function would go to both slits. But now the non-equilibrium distribution, it has only support, let's say, on the lower part of the slit. So that means that the particle would always come here. And so you would observe this kind of interference pattern in which you have only contribution in the lower slit of the in the lower part of the plane. And now you could imagine that if you could find such non-equilibrium distribution and use them, they would lead to different predictions than standard quantum theory. And now I will analyze this claim in a bit more details. So the claim is that you start from some distribution which is initially different from psi squared. You let it evolve, and is it the case that after some relaxation time tau, the non-equilibrium distribution is roughly equivalent to psi squared? And actually, you can prove that this relation can never hold unless you do some coarse-graining. And the reason is the following. You have this property. Well, if you do the calculation, you can find out that the ratio between the non-equilibrium density, rho Tx, and psi squared has to be conserved along the trajectory. So now it means that, let's consider this trajectory. You have at some initial time T0, the particle is at some position x0, and then it ends up at some time t at position x. Now, if you use this relation, you find that the non-equilibrium density at time t position x is equal to psi squared multiplied by this ratio, where rho t is 0, x0, that's the non-equilibrium distribution at this point, divided by psi squared at this point. So if these two are initially different from each other, well, then you can conclude that rho tx is necessarily different from psi squared. And this means that relaxation to quantum equilibrium, if it holds, it cannot hold at the level of x, but you have to do some kind of coarse-graining. And here the bar over this distribution would mean a coarse-graining, like a smoothing. But now it's also possible to find out counterexample to the claim that there is relaxation to quantum equilibrium in all the cases, even if you do a coarse-graining. And this, for instance, these are counterexamples, like the hydrogen atom. So if you consider an eigenstate of the energy with the quantum number m equal to 0, so if you remember from the first lecture, nothing moves. So if you start from a distribution which is different from psi squared, and if nothing moves, there is no way that it can relax to quantum equilibrium. Well, the same for a plane wave. If you have a plane wave solution, then the particle moves with uniform velocity. And, well, if it's concentrated in some region, it will simply move, but there is no way that it can spread and reproduce and be uniformly distributed. But, of course, that's the plane wave. You have to consider a packet. And that's also the case for a Gaussian wave packet. You can show that if you start from a non-equilibrium distribution, there is no way that it can relax to quantum equilibrium. But to this kind of counterexample, you can reply that they are too trivial. For instance, the hydrogen atom, it has not been sitting there in an eigenstate of the energy since the time when the first hydrogen atoms were formed. Right? The hydrogen atom has been interacting with other systems, and simply because these systems are interacting, that could drive them to quantum equilibrium. So you cannot consider wave functions which are too trivial. So, like stationary, for instance, stationary states. Another thing is time reversal. So the Brellbaum theory, it has the property of time reversal invariance. And now it means that if I use this property of time reversal invariance, and if I have this claim that non-equilibrium distribution relax to quantum equilibrium after some characteristic time tau, so I could do a time reversal, and I would have this example in which I have a non-equilibrium, a quantum equilibrium distribution that would go to non-equilibrium simply by using the time reversal of the de Brellbaum theory. And here the answer is that when there is this process of relaxation to quantum equilibrium, what is happening is that if you start from a non-equilibrium distribution which has no fine-grained structure, as it will evolve, it will acquire a fine-grained structure. And if you do the time reversal, you would start from a very weird equilibrium distribution, which is very, very fine-grained, so that's not like a real example. This I get more difficult. Okay. So the conclusion of what I said is, if relaxation to quantum equilibrium holds, you have to do some kind of coarse-graining, and you should not consider systems which are too trivial. So that's all that there is to take from that. And the first relaxation simulation were done by Anthony Valentini and Hans Westman. And what they have considered is a particle in a two-dimensional box. And for a wave function, they took a superposition of the first 16 modes of energy with some arbitrary phase, theta mn. And each of these eigenstates equal weight. And so that's how psi squared look like at the initial time t0. And that's the non-equilibrium distribution that they have considered, which is different from psi squared time t equals 0. And also, this non-equilibrium distribution, it has no fine-grained structure. And here are the results of the simulation. So the first row, that's time t equals to 0. The second row, that's time t equal to pi. And the third row, that's time t equal to 4 pi. And on the second column, you have the time evolution of psi squared. And on the first column, you have the time evolution of the non-equilibrium density. So you see that even if you start from something which is different from psi squared at the initial time t0, and if you let it evolve, there is this process of relaxation to quantum equilibrium. The non-equilibrium distribution already at time t equal 4 pi starts to look like the distribution psi squared. No, I'll say something about how they did the simulation, because it's kind of important in order to understand how does the ingredients for this process of relaxation to quantum equilibrium. So they've considered this box, so that's 0 pi, 0 pi, and they have divided the box in a certain number of coarse-graining cells. And these would be the blue cells. And for each of these cells, you take a sample of uniformly distributed points. For instance, for some coarse-graining cell, you could use like 1,000 points. And for each of these points inside of a coarse-graining cell, you could use this relation that I've mentioned previously. The fact that the ratio between rho s and psi squared is conserved along the trajectory, in order to compute the final non-equilibrium density. For instance, if you have some point here, dx, you have to find out the initial position from which the particles come from, t0, x0. And once you have found out the initial condition, you can use this relation. In order to have the value of the non-equilibrium density for the causeway for this blue cell, you simply have to average over all the points which are inside the cell. And so I'm mentioning the procedure because as I will show, it will illustrate that the fact that Bohmian trajectories are chaotic is important for relaxation to quantum equilibrium. So let's first assume that there is no chaos in Bohmian trajectories. So for all the point that you have inside a coarse grinding cell, you would have to find out the set of initial position from which they come from. But if there is no divergence in the trajectories, it would, roughly speaking, you could say that it behaves as a single trajectory. Well, roughly speaking. But then, simply by using this relation, you can show that relaxation to quantum equilibrium cannot hold at the level of the trajectory. On the other hand, if there is some chaos if there is some chaotic behavior in the Bohmian trajectory, that's a possibility that's what you need indeed to have the relaxation to quantum equilibrium. And after the paper was published, some authors have pointed out that the source for chaos in Bohmian trajectory would probably come from the node of the wave function. And usually, I will illustrate this, but when the particle goes close to a node, then it tends to circulate, because nodes are associated to vorticity in this theory. So now if you found out somewhere in the universe some ensembles in which the particles are not distributed according to the standard probability, so these non-equilibrium distribution, you could use them to do various things. You could transmit some information faster than light. You could break like security protocols. Well, you can do a lot of stuff. And now the claim is that, so even if the universe started in a state of quantum non-equilibrium, so even if there is this process of relaxation to quantum equilibrium, there is the possibility that some particle, some very, very special particle, would still be in non-equilibrium today. And I'll explain now how this possibility might arise. So here's the example. So below you have psi squared, and here you have the initial non-equilibrium distribution. And you see they are different from each other. Now, if you have for relaxation to quantum equilibrium, the crucial thing is to do this kind of coarse grinding. You have to do this coarse grinding in order to see this process of relaxation to quantum equilibrium. But on the other hand, if you put this particle on an expanding space, it would act as a kind of anti-coarse grinding. So any difference between rho and psi squared would be, if you want, would be stretched out to much larger scales. So if you have particles in non-equilibrium, and if you put these on an expanding space, you have two kind of competing mechanisms. You have the usual process of relaxation to quantum equilibrium, and you have the fact that space is expanding and acts against the coarse graining. And so Valentini has been looking for the kind of particles that would be like candidates that would still be in non-equilibrium today. And in fact, these particles, they need to decouple very early. So let's imagine that, so they start in quantum non-equilibrium. But if they have this possibility to interact with other system, this other system would drive them to quantum equilibrium. So the only way that they can remain in quantum non-equilibrium is if they decouple very early from the other. And the last suggestion of Valentini was that the gravitino, so that's the partner of the graviton in supersymmetric theories, would be a good candidate for non-equilibrium. Well, there is this possibility that you can still observe this non-equilibrium today through the decay products of this gravitino. And now I will explain so these two more recent work. So the one which first I will explain the one which Warstreif. And so it's related to this idea that you can construct infinitely many theories like the Breuboom theories, and that which simply differ by the way in which the wave function guides the particle. So if you remember, in the usual de Breuboom theory, we use so this guidance equation for the particle, V equal to J divided by psi squared, because J and psi squared are part of a continuity equation. And this is what ensures that if you start from some distribution which is given by psi squared at the initial time T0, it would remain distributed according to psi squared for any later time t. But now I could also add some curl term here. So if I add a curl term, if I take the divergence of this curl term, this gives me zero. So alternatively, I could define a theory in which the velocity of the particle is given by J plus this curl term divided by psi squared. And this would also reproduce the prediction of standard quantum mechanics. And in fact, these authors, the author and Girardi, they have shown that when you consider all these alternative theories, even if you impose additional constraints like Galilean invariance or other constraints, you still end up in the end with infinitely many, many theories that give the same prediction as standard quantum mechanics. And in fact, if you consider the Dirac equation, and if you take its non-relativistic limit, you get such a correction to the usual guidance equation. So we have studied, so our goal was to study how does this curl term influence the process of relaxation to quantum equilibrium. And so we have also considered a particle in a 2D box, but we only took a superposition of four modes, also with some arbitrary space, and each of the eigenstate as equal weight in the superposition. So here is what the density look like at the initial time t equal to 0. And we have also considered different non-equilibrium distribution. So the same one that Valentini and Westman considered. So the kind of Gaussian shape non-equilibrium distribution. But we have also considered the same distribution when the support is only one quadrant. So that's the box, and we have considered also this non-equilibrium distribution in which the support of the non-equilibrium distribution is restricted to one of the quadrants of the box. And we have considered different possibilities for this curl term, and also different coupling mu. So that would be the strength of the coupling to this curl term. I'll just show you one result. So on the top row, you have psi squared at time t equals 0, time t equals 4 pi, and time t equals 8 pi. So on the second row, you have the usual Dobrel-Bohm theory. So that's the initial non-equilibrium distribution. You let it evolve, and that's what you find for time t equals 4 pi. And that's what you find for t equals 8 pi. And you see it starts to look like psi squared, but it's not there yet. And these two theories here, so these are alternative Dobrel-Bohm type theories in which a curl term is included. And so you see here in this one, you have a much faster relaxation to quantum equilibrium. And in the last one, in which this coupling mu is increased from 1 to 2, you also have a much faster relaxation to quantum equilibrium, even faster than this one if you look at the for time t equal to 4 pi. Yes?
There's some technical sense in which these things are going to converge. I mean, as they start getting close to quantum equilibrium,
Then there's going to get, and they're going to eventually get there versus the situation where maybe it's just going to oscillate and at time t equals 8 pi it might look a lot like quantum equilibrium but then it oscillates back to something else. Well, there is this part that I skipped, I mentioned, you know, there was all this counter example where I was discussing like the hydrogen atom, then there was time reversal, and then there was Poincaré recurrence theorem. And in fact, Poincaré recurrence theorem tells exactly what you are mentioning. If you take, for instance, a periodic in time wave function, and if you wait for some Poincaré recurrence time, so the non-equilibrium distribution is going to come back very close to its initial configuration. So it could go back to some non-equilibrium distribution. But the amount of time it spends there, well, it might be negligible compared to the. But no, that's true. But that's the example I'm mentioning. That's for a periodic wave function. I think that for most of them, the idea is that roughly, once they are close to quantum equilibrium, they kind of remain close to. And so here are a few trajectories in order to illustrate what the difference between all these theories. And so here you have the first box. It represents the trajectory of the node. Well, in fact, the wave function that we have considered, the superposition of four modes, it has only one node, and the node is moving like this. That's the trajectory of the node. So here what you see, that's a particle that start initially from the center of the box and that moves from time t equal to 0 to time t equal to 4 pi. And that's the usual Dobrel-Bohm theory. And all the other trajectory that you see, these correspond to alternative Dobrel-Bohm type of theories in which a curl term has been included. Well, as you can see, well, of course, you can see this curl term. The fact why it's called a curl term when you look at the trajectories. And sometimes, with this curl term, the node can also act as a kind of attractor. This was a weird example. But you had this idea of a much more curly motion when you consider this alternative, the Breitbaum type theory with this curl term. So it is also an example of the claim that the particle starts to circulate around the node. So here there's the red trajectory, that's the node. And the blue trajectory, that's the trajectory of a particle that starts initially very close to the node. You see, for instance, in this theory, so that the correspond to this diagram. So the node acts as a very strong attractor. Right? And here it's a bit more loose, but you still have this behavior that the particle tends to circulate around the node. But this is also true in the usual De Broglie-Bohm theory. But so we wanted to understand so why is this relaxation to quantum equilibrium much faster when we include this curl term? And you can think about two reasons. So as I said in the beginning, these nodes they are important for relaxation to quantum equilibrium. Well, they are the source for chaos in they are thought to be the source for chaos in Bohmian trajectories. And around this node, you have this vorticity, so this kind of curly behavior. So you can think that, well, if I include theories in which I have curl terms, I'm kind of simulating the node, the behavior around the node, even when the particle is not close to a node. Do I make myself clear? Probably not. So the source of chaos in the usual De Broglie-Bohm theory, that's the node. That's the node which is providing chaos in the trajectory. And chaos, that's important for relaxation to quantum equilibrium. In the usual De Broglie-Bohm type theory, what is happening was when the particle goes through a node, the particle starts to... The node acts as a kind of vortex. So the particles start to go around the node. Now, if I consider alternative De Broglie-Bohm type theories, I also have this kind of curly behavior, even when the particle is not close to a node. So you could think that these kind of curl terms, they are just kind of providing the same behavior as you would expect when the particle is not close to a node. This time it's clearer. Okay. And also, you could also think that if you consider the length of the path of the particle, you see that when we include this curl term, the length of the path is much more longer. So maybe simply because the particle is moving all over the place, it has more chances to encounter the node more quickly, and then that would speed up the process of relaxation to quantum equilibrium. So you could think about two reasons why the presence of this curl term would lead to faster relaxation to quantum equilibrium. And now to illustrate this behavior, so I have an animation. So here the red star that you see, that's the node. And so these four color dots, they correspond to particles. And that's the situation, that's the usual De Broglie-Bohm theory. There is no curl term. And you see they start very close to the node and they tend to circulate in circles around it. And here you already have this, you see that you already have chaos in the trajectory. So the three of them are together and one has been carried away with the node. And simply because they were starting very close to a node. So this chaos, this illustration of chaos provided by the node, it has come very quickly simply because they started, all the particles started very close to the node initially. So now you can consider the situation in which the particle, they start at the center of the box, and so they are a bit further from the node. And you see here, they tend to bunch up together, so there is no real chaos in the trajectory, but they are far from the node. So you see they kind of follow each other. At some point, they will go close to the node, and the node will provide this chaotic behavior. So you see they are still bunched together. Up. Okay, now it's one has been taken away by the node. Well, you get the spirit about why the node is providing this chaotic behavior. And now here there's the same situation, but in which a curl term has been included. So that's an alternative to De Broglie-Bohm type theories. And that's the same situation. They all start roughly in the center of the box. You see they move very fast, but they tend to stay together, but at some point they will get close enough to a node and they will be So it's difficult to pinpoint exactly what's happening. So either whether the node is still, well, the node still seems to be still important in the chaotic behavior. So that was the part with warp. And now I will explain this more recent work, and it's about studying the process of relaxation to quantum equilibrium in Bohm's dynamics. And that's collaboration with Warstreuve and Anthony Valentini. And if you remember from the first lecture, I was presenting all this title, and I should have called this theory. And in the end, I said introduction to the theory of De Broglie and Bohm might not be such a bad name because in the end, I will explain why you can think about these two theories as being two different theories. So let's go back to Bohm's formulation of 1952. So Bohm assumed a Newton-like kind of equation of motion for the particle. So you have the acceleration that's minus the gradient of the usual potential minus the gradient of the quantum potential. So that's, if you want, that's the guidance equation in Bohm's dynamics, the second order formulation. And Bohm puts an additional constraint on the initial velocity of the particle. So the initial velocity of the particle are given by a gradient of the phase divided by the mass. And this constraint is compatible with this guidance equation. It means that if this is the case for some initial time t0, it will be the case for any later time t. But so this is a constraint. plus you have the other constraint, which is assuming that the particles are initially distributed according to psi squared, which is the usual equivariance. So Bohm's dynamics, you can think of it as being this guidance equation plus two constraints. One on the velocity, on the initial velocity, and one on the initial distribution of the position particles. On the other hand, if you consider the Brouwer's dynamic, the Brouwer's dynamics, that's only this, here is the guidance equation. And the assumption that you have to make, it's at the level of rho equal to psi squared. But now, in principle, Bohm's dynamics, if you consider non-equilibrium distribution, it's much more rich because you could also relax this constraint here. You could start from ensembles in which the velocity of the particle, initially, they are different from the gradient of the phase divided by the mass. And plus, you could also relax this second condition here. So here's a kind of picture of the situation. Here you have the usual, the standard quantum theory. And the red line, that's the Brouwer's dynamics. And now if you start from ensembles in which non-equilibrium ensembles, they would relax to quantum equilibrium. And then you would reproduce the prediction of standard quantum mechanics. Well, except, of course, for these very exotic non-equilibrium relic particles that would lead to different predictions. And now what I will show that in the next slide is that in Bohm's dynamics, it's very easy to start from a non-equilibrium distribution that would not relax to quantum to the standard quantum theory. So on the other hand, another way to put it is that if you consider non-equilibrium distribution in Bohm's dynamics, you don't have this process of relaxation to quantum equilibrium. But now where Bohm's dynamics, so there's nothing wrong in what Bohm did in 1952. But here we are simply kind of enlarging the spectrum of the theories. But when you try to do that, you can easily find a counterexample to the claim that all non-equilibrium distribution in Bohm's dynamics would relax to this point here. And you should think about De Broglie's formulation as being more fundamental, because there is this process of relaxation to quantum equilibrium. And the counterexample, you can easily find this in the study of a bound system like the hydrogen atom. So here you would have the proton. And here there's a trajectory of the electron in which you start from the initial condition V equal to grad S. You start from you don't modify this one. You take V equal to grad S and you compute the trajectory of the electron. But now it's I could easily start from an initial condition in which I give a small impulse, a radial outward impulse to the electron. So So P would be grad S divided by M plus a small contribution that would lead to some initial velocity in the outward radial direction. And if you do this, you can easily find, well, if you do the numerical simulation, you find out that the electron would simply fly away from the center of the from the proton. So if you if there is this initial small kick, then the electron will simply simply fly off. And so it means that if I start from some non-equilibrium distribution in which the electron over an ensemble FV equal grad S plus a small contribution in the outward direction, well, there is no way that the system could relax to quantum equilibrium, because all the electrons would simply fly away to infinity. So in Bohm's dynamics, it's easy to find a counter. Well, easy. You can find counterexample to the claim that all system would relax to quantum equilibrium. So that was the second work. So here is the conclusion of this small course. So the Breuil-Bohm theory, well, you may or may not like it, but that's an example of the, well, some even call it cheap modification of quantum mechanics. But that's an example of the fact that indeterminism is not forced upon us. Neither do you need this kind of vague distinction between system and observers. You can have a realistic interpretation of quantum mechanics. That was the point of the first lecture. And now, if you go to quantum field theory, so there are various proposals in order to extend the de Broglie-Bohm theory to quantum field theory. And the conclusion was that for boson, so the solution that seems to work, that's field-able for boson, and for fermions, on the other hand, only point-like beables for fermion. So that was the good solution. You have at the moment, you have kind of two different ontologies for bosons and fermions. And you also had this issue about bare particles. And this is something that has not really been addressed properly. And also, well, so one interesting thing to do there might be to study supersymmetric quantum field theory, because there you would have unification of boson and fermion at the standard level. And you would see what it would lead to at the level of the de Broglie-Bohm pilot wave theory. Maybe it would say something about this problem, if you think about this as a problem at all. But then you have all these models with very different beables, and the point is that the choice of beable that you do, that's going to matter for all these studies of relaxation to quantum equilibrium. For instance, if you have a theory in which you take fermions as point-like beables, or if you have a theory in which field configuration are the beables, they have no reason to behave in the same way as far as relaxation to quantum equilibrium is concerned. So that's going to have probably important consequences in the time that follows for this study of relaxation to quantum equilibrium. Okay, that's about it. Well, thanks for listening. So do you have any questions?
So for relaxation, if there are no nodes at all, does that mean that it'll take a longer time to relax, or it won't at all? Are those the cases that don't relax?
Yeah, they would. If there is no node at all, then it would take like a very, very, very long time to relax. And the more nodes you have, the faster the relaxation. Yes. Yeah, I think that the most recent understanding was that nodes were essential for this relaxation to quantum equilibrium. Yeah?
So I would imagine that the non-local nature of this interpretation is probably a big criticism. I'm just wondering how how you would respond to that. Is there some physical justification for allowing these, allowing the product positions to all talk to each other?
I love it. It's like, well, the fact that the theory is non-local, well, the way I see the see things, so you have two things, right? You have the DPR paradox, and you have Bell's inequalities and the experiment that have confirmed under quantum mechanics. So the essence of the DPR paradox was that you have these kind of non-local correlations. And the only way to explain this correlation is by assuming that there are some kind of local hidden variable theories. But so Bell has shown that no local hidden variable theory can reproduce the traditional standard quantum mechanics. But then if you want to explain this correlation, you are left with non-locality. And of course, this non-locality in the standard interpretation is kind of hidden in the collapse postulate. Even in the Breitbart theory, it's much more explicit. But
so I guess the question is, what's the justification for adopting the hidden variable theory versus
standard interpretation?
So how would the Bohmian defend himself against one who would ask, what gives you the right to think about particle positions as positive properties? Predefined before measurements.
Well, the reason why you do this is just to eliminate this kind of vague division between systems and an observer. So, for instance, standard interpretation, what does it mean to have like a wave function of the universe? There is no observer. So personally, what I don't like about standard interpretation is you have this division, you have, okay, as long as I don't do any measurement, my system evolves according to the Schrödinger equation, which is a deterministic continuous equation. When some observer makes a measurement, the system collapses. Hmm? So yet, this division, let's say, of the world between quantum world and classical world, system learns server, and you don't see what. So that's the vagueness that was pointed out there. It's just having a clear formulation of the theory that doesn't involve concepts which are ill-defined. Now, in the Breitbart theory, the explanation of the measurement problem is clear. You see how the introduction of position is sufficient to select one definite outcome in a measurement-like situation.
Have you thought at all about if there's any relationship between Breitbart and Nelson's mechanics? Or have people thought about that at all?
No, I think that the people have thought about it. So maybe, I think that Batcher, Guido Batcher, could be. He has a bit like the kind of connection between Nelson mechanics and the Breitbart theory.
So there was a lot of references to ensembles. Mm-hmm. Is there a way to make sense of quantum mechanics with a different interpretation of probability? Is there any way to be Bayesian about Bohmianism?
Well, the one that tries to be Bayesian, well, I know at least two people who are Bayesian about Bohmian mechanics. So there is Howard Wiseman. So he has this paper grounding Bohmian mechanics in wave values and Bayesianism. And the other person I can think of is Jean Pecmont. So the, at some point there was a, so there was a reference from paper. It's, what is it now? Is it Bohm, Bayes, and so I can find the reference after and give it to you. But at least, yeah, there are at least two people who think that it's perfectly reasonable to have a Bayesian point of view on the theory. Third question. Thanks again for thanks for listening.
Thanks for the question.
Thank you.